And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho. Welcome to the show where we interview legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Jock Bartley is known for his melodic, tasteful, and fiery lead guitar style, influencing many rock and country rock guitarists. Leaving college to pursue music, he joined the Boulder Bass Band Zephyr, replacing Tommy Bolin as lead guitarist. Tommy, of course, joined the James Gang after that, later Deep Purple, before his untimely death in 1977. Months after the Sunset Ride album came out, Zephyr broke up. 1972, Jock was asked to join the touring band of the legendary Graham Parsons and the Fallen Angels, featuring Emmylou Harris. Graham had joined the Byrds on the groundbreaking Sweetheart of the Radio album, formed the Flying Burrito Brothers with Chris Holman, and was a pioneer of the new musical genre, country rock. The Fallen Angels tour made many memorable stops from Texas to Boston, including a show in Houston where Neil Young and Linda Ronstadt sat in on stage. Emmylou and Linda met that night and sang together for the first time. At Max's Kansas City in New York City, Jock met Boulder resident Rick Roberts, who we had on the show, who'd replaced Graham and the Burrito Brothers and had two solo albums out. In 74, Rick and Jock began jamming in Boulder with Mark Andes, who we just talked with. Mark, bassist from the progressive L.A. band Spirit, and JoJo Gunn. When Larry Burnett arrived from D.C., Fire Up Fall was formed. A few months in, drummer Michael Clark, formerly of the Byrds and Flying Burrito Brothers, joined the band. Rick, Mark, and Jock were on tour with Chris Holman on the East Coast when Chris became ill. Larry and Michael were flown in, and Firefall finished the engagement at the Bitter End in New York City, where Atlantic Records came to hear, soon signing them to a long-term contract. David Muse joined the band in rehearsals with producer Jim Mason. Firefall recorded their first album at Criteria Studios in the winter of 1975, during which his guitar hero Eric Clapton was in the control room while Jock played the one-take lead guitar track on Mexico. It was a good thing I didn't know he was watching. I wouldn't have been able to hold my pick or play one note, says Jock. Jock has played on stage with artists including Stephen Stills, Neil Young, the Doobie Brothers, Dan Fogelberg, Journey, Heart, Poco, John Mayall, and many, many others. He's a spokesman for suicide prevention, having worked with the American Association of Suicidology and the Christian Brooks Hope Center to put on benefit concerts to raise awareness, help fund the first national crisis line, 800-SUICIDE, and save lives. He's also involved with causes including child abuse, domestic violence, burn victims, camps, environmental issues, and others. Jock is a record producer, travels frequently to Nashville to write songs, and gives seminars on creativity and songwriting for the Nashville Songwriters Association and the Songwriters Guild. Endorses Paul Reed Smith Guitars and Takamine Guitars. He has produced an acclaimed instructional songwriting video called The Complete Guide to Songwriting, How to Write a Song. Jock has also been a painter and fine artist since childhood, but only since 2001 has he gotten serious about his new art career. His colorful paintings and pastels in a wide variety of subjects have begun receiving wide critical and public acclaim. His work has been exhibited in art galleries in Denver and Vail, Colorado, and Reno, Nevada, with more to come. Purchasing a few shows featuring rock and roll artists His paintings have hung next to John Lennon lithos and paintings by Ronnie Wood of the Stones, Gray Slick, and others. In 2006, four of the Beatles' paintings appeared in a nationally released coffee table book, Beatles Art, Fantastic New Artwork of the Fab Four. Jock's paintings and prints were included in the Denver Children's Hospital benefit, Rockers for Kids, featuring art by Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, John Mellencamp, Jerry Garcia, David Bowie, Ron Wood, Grace Slick, Janis Joplin, and R. Crumb, and other artists. Jock Bartley and Firefall will be on the road again beginning June 9th in Norfolk, Virginia at Harborfest. Please welcome Jock Bartley, legendary guitarist, singer, and songwriter, to the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, Jock.
How's it going, Ray? That was a long piece that you just read.
Well, you've had a long career.
I guess so. I feel old.
No, you guys are in great shape. I'm so happy with the current Firefall lineup.
Me too.
You know, I'm happy that David's there, you, Mark. We just talked to Mark recently. It's awesome. It's one of my favorite bands of all time. You guys deserve superstardom. And, I guess you had a couple of obstacles in your way along the way, but, you know, just a fantastic
band. Yeah, we had a couple of obstacles that didn't quite make it. But you know what? The great thing about Firefall, and, you know, my hat's off to the original singer-songwriters, Rick Roberts and Larry Burnett in the band.
Yeah.
From our first day of rehearsal in Boulder, Colorado, back in about 74, we had 25 or 30 original songs by Rick and Larry to work out. So Mark
wow.
and I were in just heaven going, okay, hey, you got anything else? And they say, sure. You know, we had so many good songs, and I think that's the reason that Firefall has, you know, continued for so many decades and also pretty much thrived in the industry and are still a good ticket seller because of how great those songs were and the magical performances that we made during the studio.
Well, you know, you guys are just great musicians. That's something that kind of lacks today, you know, on mainstream radio. You guys are just great
yeah.
musicians, you know?
You know, it's interesting because, yeah, when Firefall had two very prolific singer-songwriters in the band, and then you had Mark Andy's one of the best bass players on the planet.
Yeah.
You know, so tasty and so solid. I mean, Mark is unbelievable. Myself, who's trained and, you know, a rocker from way back when, David Muse, the multi-instrumentalist from Clearwater, Florida, who plays damn near every instrument known to man. And then the legendary Michael Clark on drums, the king of 4/4. You know, we had some really great musicians in the band, and we had two great singer-songwriters in the band, and, you know, and I think it was destined to be.
Plus, we have a mutual friend, our buddy Joe Lala, who was also part of the band.
Yep.
And played on a few albums. You know, Joe, you know, when I talked to Joe, he was always wanting to be an official member of Firefall. He always told me that.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that, although whenever we played in Florida and out on the road, sometimes when the band could afford it, we would definitely bring him out. Joe Lala played such an amazing role on all of our albums, at least the first four, you know, the first 4 years or something. He was all over that and was just the best percussionist in rock and roll for 15, 20 years. So saddening and sorrowful when he passed a couple of years ago, but man, he was amazing. And you know, the sidelight that not too many people know is Firefall's song "It Doesn't Matter," which was written by Chris Hillman and Rick Roberts when they were in the Flying Burrito Brothers together. Although it never was recorded, the Firefall version, which came out on our first album in 1976, when Chris left the Breeder Brothers and joined into Stephen Stills and Manassas. That was one of the songs he took. Stephen really liked the song, although he changed a lot, most of the lyrics. And And that would be the second version of It Doesn't Matter. Joe Lala played on both versions of It Doesn't Matter, and it's just so cool to hear that and to hear a great song like that. And we miss Joe, for sure.
Yeah, he was a great guy. You know, he was 100% Sicilian, but to me, he acted more Cuban than anything else because of his association with Ybor City. And my mom was Cuban, so I really, you know, he was like part of the family for me.
Oh, yeah. For the first 4 or 5 years that I knew Joe back in the 70s and early 80s, I thought he was Cuban. And then when I heard that he wasn't, I went, oh, my gosh, really? He played. He had the best feel, and you can listen to any of those Fireball songs, the big hits or even the album cuts, and all over it and just added such a sound to a rock solid with Michael Clark and Mark Andy.
Yeah, he was so happy with that reunion show. I think it was in 2008 at the Boulder Theater. He was so happy. He said he had such a wonderful time at that.
That was really great. And, you know, after a while, I just figured, you know, we have to do this reunion show, you know, whether Rick Roberts was in condition to. Of course, has had some problems and voice problems and stuff, and you know, it was just so fulfilling to have everybody come into Boulder and play a gig, and Rick was in the audience, and we, you know, talked about him and talked to him, you know, every chance we could get, and you know, because without Rick Roberts, there would have been an earfall. And, you know, Rick was such an amazing songwriter. When he had those two A&M solo albums out, and he and I started working, we were initially thinking that I would just be a guitar player on his next solo record. But as soon as Mark Andes got in the fold, it was like, oops, I think we're bad. And that's when Rick said, hey, I know a guy in D.C. who's got some great songs, and he and I sound great singing together. We should get him out here. And suddenly Larry Burnett was a Colorado resident too, and you know, the rest is kind of history.
I'm originally from D.C., and he actually became a disc jockey, I think WCXR radio. He was on the air in D.C. after Firefall.
Right.
Yeah.
For a number of years. And then also, because Larry has such a resonant, great voice, he did. He made a living doing voiceover dubs for radio and other things, you know, stuff. So yeah, Larry's voice and Rick's voice together would just—I mean, that's when I listen to the Firefall records that we made back in the '70s. You know, their vocal blend was just incredibly, you know, moving and just, you know, it was really great together, and their songs went the gamut from, you know, Larry's hard rock songs to his lighter songs. And Larry kind of was a darker personality than Rick Roberts was. And Ricky's harder rock songs and then his ballads. When you put all of them together, suddenly you had this wide range of songs that Michael and Mark and David and I were just so happy to lend our hand to also. And we had a synergy making records that very few bands ever have, and we never had to try to sound like us. When we'd work out a song, it would sound like Firefall, and I think a lot of that was due to Michael Clark's drumming and Mark Andes' bass playing and my guitar playing and David's flute and sax work. You know, I've been blessed in my musical career and my life, and it's amazing, you know, 40-plus years later to still be doing it.
Well, you guys had 3 gold albums, 2 platinum albums, 11 hit singles, including You Are the Woman and Just Remember I Love You, which was a Billboard number 1. The single You Are the Woman has been played on commercial radio over 7 million times. And you guys were inducted into the Colorado Music Hall of Fame in 2015, so congratulations for that.
Well, thank you very much. That induction class was amazing. It was the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, Poco, that had Richie Fury and Timothy B. Schmidt back in the band for that one night,
yep.
And a tribute to Stephen Stills and Manassas, and Firefall. Yep. It was like, boy, what a class to be inducted with.
Well, you belong there. You guys are awesome. You still are awesome.
Well, thank you.
You know, yeah. I was fortunate to see you guys play twice, and I saw Mark play with Spirit a while ago. But I remember seeing you guys in Hollywood, Florida, backing up Hart. You were on
yeah.
the tour with Hart. Yeah. You guys were incredible. You know, my favorite.
Well, thanks. You know, and like I say, you know, it sure was great, and it was interesting, though, because after You Are the Woman was such a big hit in 1976, our record label, Atlantic, basically really wanted to have like 5 or 8 You Are the Woman per record, and they wanted this to be that light, poppy, you know, soft rock band, but we were a harder rocking unit, you know, that had 2 or 3 or 4 really nice ballads per record. So it was always interesting. We always wanted them to put out some of the harder material and the more rockin'
right.
stuff, but they kept putting, you know, and they, hey, there's nothing wrong with Just Remember I Love You and You Are the Woman is great, and, you know, that's the reason those songs are really pretty much the reason we still work a lot, you know,
right.
here in 2018. But, you know, we're a rockin' band, and when people who are only familiar with our albums come out and see it, you know, they're kind of surprised that we rock so much, and that Mark and I dig in and jam, and it's just so much fun to still be doing this.
Your album, is it Elan? Is that how you pronounce that?
It's called Elan.
Elan, okay.
Elan, which the word means verve or going or excitement or something. And,
right.
You know, that's just what we picked for the third album.
That was, I think, your best album, right, as far as commercial-wise?
Probably, yeah. Between our third and our first album, you know, definitely our Elan album, our third album, was the quickest one to go platinum, and that was right when we were on the road with Fleetwood Mac during the Rumors.
Right.
And, you know, and playing with Lynyrd Skynyrd and Doobie Brothers and the band and all these people, that it was just like, well, the band was a little bit earlier. But we were just so fortunate in our timing, you know, that we then got to become players on the road with all the best bands.
You guys were riding on such a high, and then a little turmoil during that album. I think Tom Dowd was brought in to produce it. Then they brought in, you guys brought in Ron and Howard Albert to finish the record. And then there's an issue with your management, right? Where, but wasn't Mick Fleetwood thinking about taking over or something like that?
Well, that brings up 3 or 4 different issues, but basically the Tom Dowd album we made, when Rick and Larry presented the songs that we were going to work out, and we took those songs and recorded them, Tom Dowd, who is and was one of the most amazing producers
right.
in the music business ever, his vision of our third record was kind of like a Crosby, Stills, and Nash thinner mm-hmm. record without a lot of doubled guitars or doubled voices, and we don't need drums on every track, and it was just kind of, you know, his vision of the band ended up being, you know, somewhat different than what we thought. And at that critical moment when we finished the album and Tom mixed it and moved on to his next project, Atlantic Records CEO Ahmet Erdogan came in and said, I think you need to go back in and redo some of the album. No problem, boys. You're out on the road and we're back and having fun. You know, Rick, write a few more songs, and we'll go back in 3 or 4 or 5 months and record, you know, and record a few new songs and kind of just beef things up. So the
right.
actual, you know, Ahmet allowed us to then go redo the record. And when Tom was busy doing other artists at that time, and we decided to stay at Criteria Studios and went with Ron and Howard Albert, who had done anybody from Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Stephen Stills to Dave Mason Records and stuff. And they came in and we beefed it up and we did, you know, doubled or tripled acoustic guitars to make it fatter and more vocals and added drums to Sweet and Sour on my song, which had been kind of a real Crosby, Stills, and Nash kind of lighter song with no drums. And so we kind of just added to it and put it out, and sure enough, Strange Way, out of the box, went into the top 10 and stayed there most all summer.
That's my favorite
song. In 1978.
That's my favorite song, Strange Way. I love that song.
Yeah.
And
David, you know, David's flute solo on the end of that, when we turn into the kind of a Latin feel, mm-hmm. you know, and have him take it off, I mean, that is the high point of every gig we ever play. Yet, if you play in Mexico or Firefall, singing You're the Woman or whatever, there's a lot of high points, and we get a lot of standing ovations and stuff. But David's flute solo in Strange Way is always, night after mm-hmm. night after night live, the high point of our show. And it's just great because David kills it, and the song was a huge hit. And, you know, it just takes people back to where they were in 1978.
And then Joe Lalla comes in. I saw a gig you guys did in a college in Florida or something, but he kind of stretches it out with his congos, at the end, which is really cool. Yeah.
Yeah. When we don't have anybody playing congos or percussion on stage, you know, some of the grooves aren't exactly the same, but having Lalla play with us whenever that was, mm-hmm. you know, is just the best, was the best. And we miss Joe, and, you know, he's playing in that great band in heaven with all those people.
Is. Yeah. Now, was Fleetwood Mac, Mick Fleetwood, was he actually really thinking about managing the band?
He did. They did. He did. They did for a while.
Really?
And it was interesting because even though Ahmet Erdogan had said, why don't you guys go redo the album, mm-hmm. There was a release date. And it was going to be released in a couple of weeks. And Mick Fleetwood, we were on the road with them during not only the White Album quite a bit, but also during Rumors. And you know, going to the management question that you asked about, you know, that was one of the problems that Firefall had all along, and it was totally on our shoulders. You know, we picked the wrong manager. We couldn't keep a good manager. We had about a different manager every year for about 3 or 4 years in our heyday, and consequently suffered because of that. And at the time when we were about to get a new manager, when our third album was coming out, Kiss's manager Bill O'Coin was interested in us, and Phil Hartley, who did Loggins and Messina, was interested. And we met with them and Mick Fleetwood from Limited Management. And, and Mick came in and said, this album isn't good enough. You guys really need to beef it up some. And we said to him, well, the album that we finished was done and accepted, and we have a release date. And he said, it's never too late. And when we went with him, he flew to New York City and met with all the bigwigs of Atlantic, and they didn't have any clue what it was. They're going, Mick Fleetwood, he was like the biggest guy in the music industry that year. You know, I wonder what he would want to talk to us about. And he came up and he said, stop the presses. And, you know, and that pretty much assured us that we could redo the album, and I'm glad we did, because the album that we made wasn't as good as the one that we remade. So, you know, one of those deals happened.
Well, Elon hit platinum status. You know, I mean, you guys could have been just as big as Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, I thought. I mean, you guys were headed that way, you know. And then after Undertow, I think things kind of fell apart a little bit, right, in the band?
Yeah. And, you know, truthfully, we had a couple of guys with substance abuse problems or alcohol problems. We had, we basically put the band together back in 1975 because everybody fit a niche that we needed, you know, a great drummer, a great songwriter, a great guitar player, this and everything. As in terms of compatible personalities and being really good friends, we were, but boy, as the years went by, some of the psychological or personal issues between band members, like happens with a lot of bands, started to materialize. And when, you know, when you're out on the road, like, you know, 4 out of 5 months a year, you know, twice, you know, with a, maybe a 3 week break sometime, the pressure and the whole thing about that, and we were having financial problems with our managers, one of which sued us for way too much money that we had to deal with, and there were just so many things that were going on that by the time that Mark Andes left the band, I think it was right after Undertow, and then Michael left, and then it was Rick and Larry and David and I, and then Larry left, and then it was just Ricky and David and I, and, you know, the band started falling apart, and internally, it wasn't anybody's problem except our own, and, you know, and we kind of lost a little bit of the magic in the studio, and we're kind of, I guess, trying to grow out of that, you know, oh, pigeonhole that You Are the Woman being such a huge hit was, you know, like I said, our record label won a 10 You Are the Woman record. And, you know, we wanted to do a lot of other stuff, too. So we had an amazing run for about 4 or 5 years.
Right.
And, you know, and that's what that 4 or 5 year run at Fireball had kept us in business for 25 years after that.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you brought the band back with a lot of different lineups. And I tell you, you guys did a very good job in 93 with an album called The Great you did the song The Great Flood, which was really cool. And
oh, you mean When the River Rises?
Yeah.
You know, I was kind of a late bloomer as a songwriter.
Uh-huh.
And because I had joined into a band that had two guys that had songs coming out of every pocket. You know, and I was the good guitar player, the lead guitar player and stuff. When I started really developing into a songwriter, a lot of my songs that I would write wouldn't be the boy meets girl or boy loses girl kind of song. You know, I started, you know, being a socially conscious guy and not happy with what was going on with society. I started writing tunes that kind of came from down deep and, you know, and When the River Rises, we had done a tour of the flooded Midwest in St. Louis and Des Moines and a couple of other places where we'd go into town and they would have either canceled our show or had to put it 2 miles back from the river because the river had overflowed its banks and had, you know, inundated often Illinois, for instance. And I'll tell you, what was interesting was I had toyed with the idea of a song named When the River Rises a couple of years earlier and had it on one of my work cassette tapes. And I woke up the night after I got back from that tour, and I sat up in the dark in bed and went, When the River Rises. And what a great title. And I had just experienced, you know, people losing everything and being flooded, having, you know, all this stuff. And I went back through my tapes and actually found the 60 seconds of me kind of coming up with the idea. And once I found that, I went, wow, this is great. And I wrote a song in about, 15, 20 minutes from that and felt like, man, we need to get this out here and see if I can make a little money to help flood relief. Firefall recorded it like 2 days after I wrote the song, and about 5 days after it was finished, I took it back to St. Louis and played it on the radio for the first time, like 5 days after it was written. And what was interesting about the song to me was it's a real positive message song about, you know, being strong and gaining, gaining strength in adversity and dealing with bad stuff that's going on in your life. And, and a lot of the tunes that I had written, including my suicide prevention song and, mm-hmm. and some other ones in that kind of vein, were really positive message songs, which, when you think about it, suicide is one of the hardest, subjects to try to write anything positive about, So I was developing into a writer that kind of stretched out and did some other things. And for a few years, when the River Nurses made a little publishing money and I donated it to sources in St. Louis or Des Moines or whatever, and we played a few benefits back there, and it was just a cool deal. And interesting how music and songs can somehow help people.
It's helped me my whole life. If I didn't have music, I don't know where I'd be right now. And
no kidding.
Most people timeline their lives of what was playing on the radio at that time.
Exactly. And what the truth is? It's like I've been asked a bunch of times. Oh man, doesn't it get old when you go do these meet and greets after your show and have to shake everybody's hand and hear their story? And I went, absolutely not.
Right.
Amazing. I mean, because, you'll meet a couple that'll tell you, oh, we got married to Just Remember I Love You and have been in love since, or you don't know how much that song meant to me, or,
right.
My favorite song of Firefall is Boom, and the reason why. And you really hear people's stories, and they open up to you about how emotionally that either helped them through a hard time or helped determine what the good times were. A song of ours, and what an honor. It's like to hear that your music that I didn't even write, but I played on and that Firefall made, really helped people make it through some hard times or whatever. And it's a blessing, and it never gets old.
I still get emotional with Strange Way, to be honest with you.
Oh, really?
Every time I hear that song, I don't know what it is about that song, but it does something to me.
Right. I have a couple songs that when they play does that to me too. But what a great song. And again, the synergy of the band, when you put those six people together in the studio, seven with Joe Lala, what we did a lot of the time was really magical.
Yeah.
And of course, not every song that we recorded or every solo I played or every lyric written, on a Firefall song was great or otherworldly, but boy, those times that really just hit people, it's like I'm just real fortunate to be in the position I'm in. So.
Yeah. I got to talk about this album, excuse me, and what I understand, Redstone Records didn't have the distribution clout to get the CD into all stores, and that was Messenger. 1994, the fans loved it, and I love that album, and it's exactly what you were talking about with the songwriting. Very, very meaningful lyrics. Innocent Victim, You're Not Alone,
Right.
No Means No.
Well, you're one of the few guys that heard or liked that album.
And I thought it was a great album.
Going with a small label, it had its problems, and that was back, of course, when albums sold and publishers made money and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
The music business is so weird today, where a songwriter who's written a hit song who's gotten millions and millions of airplays and everything is still making no money. It's like, gosh, how does that work? But back then, you needed a label to kind of push things, and they kind of didn't have the clout and didn't know what we were doing, what they were doing, and it's part of what reality and stuff. But thank you for saying about those songs. You're Not Alone is actually the song. It's basically talking about a person telling someone who's in crisis, "I'm here with you. I've been there before. Come talk with me, and I'll help you through bad times." I basically stole my own lyrical idea when I was asked to write the suicide prevention song, Call on Me, which ended up becoming for about 3 or 4 or 5 years, kind of the song that was played whenever any of the suicidology people in Washington, D.C. or, you know, would be played and stuff. And I kind of plagiarized my own You're Not Alone to become Call on Me. And the song Call on Me, which is on my Blindside solo record, basically is about the guy on the hotline phone talking to a kid in crisis and saying, come on back, or, you know, come back from the edge, you know. You're important. People care about you, you know, and just talking someone down from that crisis point. And, you know, we've all been there at different times, you know, in terms of needing some advice or friendship or just some, you know, a hug or something. So, yeah, a lot of my songs come out and end up being about that kind of stuff.
I had Corey Glover, the lead singer, frontman for Living Color, on the show recently, and he did a song about suicide, that he was in a very dark place at one time, and he wrote a song about it. And I brought it up. I know it was a touchy subject for him, but, you know, God bless you for even putting that to music. You know, I lost my best friend to suicide. We've lost a lot of rockers to suicide, which is very sad. You know, I interviewed Keith Emerson. Really nice guy. The last tour for Ronnie Montrose, I was there with him and his wife.
Wow.
Larry Hoppin from New Orleans. Oh my God!
It goes on and on, and
all the military guys,
and not just musicians, of course, but
yeah,
so many musicians that basically drink themselves to death, or you know, do something that isn't like killing yourself as in what a traditional suicide would be. There's a lot of rockers and creative people who basically just, you know, can't handle it and drink themselves to death. And it's so sad. And when I was a spokesperson doing a lot of stuff with the cause, suicide prevention, you know, it was, you know, I'd go down to these conventions, play my song, meet people. Like a third of the people that were there in attendance in these nationwide conferences, a third of them would be the professionals of the suicide prevention industry out of Washington or New York. A third of the people would be the hotline phone people who talked to kids in crisis on the line, which was amazing talking to them. And the other third was parents from young people who had taken their own life, and I met a few families where there were two kids in the family that committed suicide, and it was just heart-wrenching and so sad. And a lot of times, I'm no expert on it or anything, but a lot of times it's just those people in crisis crying out for attention or crying out for somebody to pay attention to them, you know, and hear their story or hear their pain. And that's why it was so fulfilling to me to have my song Call on Me play even a really small role about starting up the first ever nationally coordinated 800 suicide hotline. So that one of the things that I thought was really great about it was that, so if there was a young person in Texas who called the National 800 Suicide Hotline, he wasn't routed to somebody in Boston who kind of talked a different language than he did.
Right.
You know, he got to he was immediately connected to the nearest location in Texas, and that made a big difference to a lot of kids. And so it was a fantastic partnership for me, and and I still do some stuff with them, and you know, my heart goes out to anybody that has those emotional problems that feels like they're all alone. And that's where music comes in, because sometimes music's all a person has.
That's right. I agree with that. You know what's sad too is a lot of people miss the signs of people that are really having trouble and having issues, and like you said, there's nobody for them to talk to. And if only somebody would sit down and listen, that might, you know, help a great deal. But, you know, sometimes it doesn't help, and, you know, they end up...
Sometimes it doesn't help, but in a lot of the cases where there was nobody to sit and listen or be empathetic or to say, hey, I'm here for you. Let me know if I can do anything for you. You know, suicide is such a terrible thing. And, I mean, obviously it's horrendous and terrible for the person who went through it. But on a person who actually commits suicide and goes through with their threats, what a terrible thing for the entire family,
exactly.
all of their friends. You know, it's like it's a national tragedy, and particularly, you know, nowadays with servicemen, American GIs that come back and have post-traumatic stress syndrome and just feel totally alone and can't cope with things, you know. So I want to help those kind of people and, you know, in any way that I can, which, you know, if music helps, great, because not being trained and not being out there, you can do what you can do. So I'm proud of Call on Me and some of the work I've done, but it was just a little trickle of what needed to be done. Same thing with the money that we raised. I did I did three different suicide prevention benefits. The first one was with Michael McDonald, and amazingly Steve Winwood was there at the Bluebird in Nashville and came up and Michael, we did Can't Find My Way Back Home by Blind Faith. God, I'm on stage with Steve Winwood, you know, and he kind of waves and he's going to get down off the stage, and Michael grabs his arm and saying, oh, no, you don't. We have to do Give Me Some Lovin', you know. And so here I am on stage with Steve Winwood singing Give Me Some Lovin' and
how cool is
singing
that?
On a mic backgrounds with Michael McDonald, another one of the greatest singers ever, and David Pack from Ambrosia was on stage. It was like, wow, I can die and go to heaven now. To play Give Me Some Lovin' with Stevie Winwood?
That is so cool. That's awesome.
No kidding.
But the story about you with Eric Clapton in the studio was so cool. I mean, like you said, it's a good thing he didn't know he was in the studio, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I sometimes tell that story before we play Mexico on stage, and, you know, it was so interesting because that's when I was playing my old Les Paul and a Fender Super, and I could sustain on any note, on any fret, on just about any, you know, anything I wanted to do, and it was like great. And Criteria, you know, we were down the hall from the Bee Gees, and Stephen
Stewart
was in another studio, and here was this unknown band, Firefall, recording a record, and people were in and out of the control room, and Jim Mason, the producer, asked me if I was ready and warmed up. I said, yeah, let's go. We played it. And it ended up being a one-take solo. And he said, come on in, that was great. And when I went in, there was Eric Clapton sitting there having watched me play, and I just crumbled. I was like, oh, wow. I turned into Jackie Gleason, you know, humming, humming, humming.
That's so cool.
And he stood up and shook my hand and said, keen playing, man, and left.
Yeah.
The only time I've ever met Eric Clapton, but so many tens of thousands of lead guitar players from my genre and my age group, I mean, Eric Clapton was it.
Yeah. I got to hang out a little bit with Alvin Lee backstage and also John Mayall. And it was Mayall's birthday, his 80th birthday here in Sarasota, in the Sarasota
area. Wow.
And I covered the show. And I knew the promoter. And the promoter, I says, well, I want to get John's set list for my review. And he grabs me, and he throws me in the dressing room, John's dressing room, and shuts the door behind me, you know. And I'm there with John Mayall, just, you know, sitting there talking and hanging out. And it was so cool. You know, it's like, you know, music aficionados would only understand what it is to be in a room with John Mayall, you know.
Right.
A lot of people today probably wouldn't, you know, but... You know, the godfather, you know, of
yeah, blues. Exactly. And it kind of goes back to that thing where a lot of American, you know, musician lover, you know, kids didn't discover the blues, you know, which was our homegrown, you know, form of music that America had, you know, all by itself. We didn't discover it until people like Clapton and John Mayall and, you know, the original Fleetwood Mac with Peter Green
yep.
came to
Peter
America
Green.
And was playing the blues. And we went, wow.
Yeah. That's very,
you know,
very
I have
true.
I have to say that in your long introduction of me, when you mentioned the night in Houston, Texas, when I was amazed to be there in not only on stage, but later in Neil and Linda's hotel
yeah.
room, and we went to Neil's suite and got to hang out pretty much until dawn with and Emmy Lou and Linda Ronstadt had just met that night, and back in the hotel room, Graham would grab a guitar, and he must have played like 50 country songs that I'd never heard of before, you know.
Yeah.
Country songs by the Lubin Brothers, and I'd never heard of them before either at that time, not being a country guy. And to watch and listen to Emmy Lou and Linda sit real close together and put their voices together for the first time in harmony was just one of the absolute highlights of my life and career.
Wow.
Unbelievable.
You played with a legend, Graham Parsons. What I understand was that you kind of turned things around a little bit. They weren't having a successful tour or something, and then you came in, and things changed after you came in, right? It got better.
I'll go with that. Really what happened was, so, now, you probably know that it was Rick Roberts and Chris Hillman, when they were in the Flying Breeder Brothers, who discovered Emmy Lou Harris playing in a little club outside of Washington, D.C.
Right. I didn't know they discovered her, no.
So it was Rick Roberts and their roadie
right.
that went to this place, saw Emmy Lou Harris. Rick calls Chris back at the hotel. Chris, come down here. You got to hear this gal.
Mm-hmm.
And Chris was going, man, I'm already in the bed. No, I just get down here. So Chris comes down from the hotel and goes and hears Emmy Lou Harris, and within about a half hour, he called Graham on the phone and said, I think we found the girl you're looking for, the female singer. And
mm-hmm.
sure enough. So anyway, when they were putting their band together, and the GP album was just being released on Warner Brothers, and they were going to go out on tour and do that, their first choice was James Burton, who Elvis was still playing and wouldn't let James go do a tour with somebody else. So
mm-hmm.
James Burton was out of the question. And their second pick was Clarence White, who was still playing with Roger McGuinn and the Byrds.
Right.
And, you know, so they're going, we don't have a guitar player. And Emmy said, I know a guy in Washington, D.C. So they flew him out sight unseen for the last few days of rehearsal in L.A. And they got on their bus, and it just so happened that their first gig in on this month-and-a-half-long tour was in Boulder, Colorado, where I live.
Hmm.
And they get out to the gig, and the guy that Emmy Lou knew, who was going to play lead guitar, was so nervous, and he was more of an acoustic guitar player and not so much an electric player, and he was not a drinker, and he was so nervous that he got pretty drunk that night, first night, just to try to get
right.
through the first gig. And the word came out, you know, we got to find a guitar player because we don't want to cancel the tour. We need a guitar player. And the manager of that club calls me and says, get your ass down here. You might have a gig. And I said, with who and what? What is what? And he said, Graham Parsons. And the following month was on. Graham Parsons said, you know, from the Byrds and the Flying Breeder Brothers. And I went, oh, okay. So I went down there and saw that first gig, and the guy did suck. And the band was not rehearsed and wasn't that great.
Right.
And the manager introduced me to Phil Kaufman and Eddie Tinkler, the manager, and to Graham. And they said, well, why don't you come and play with us tomorrow night? Just sit in with us and we'll see what happens. Now, I was not a country guy at all. I didn't know any country music. And, you know, so I really wasn't the best guy that they could have gotten. But I was a really good lead guitar player, and I was a rock player. And the story was that when I sat in with them up at the Pioneer Inn in Nederland, Colorado,
right.
they said, well, we need a good country picker, we need a good rhythm guitar player, and we need a good rock lead player. And Jock, you're two out of three of those. Because I wasn't a country picker. They could tell I was not a country guy, you know. And the guy that I was about to replace, they said, two out of three is better than zero out of three. You're hired. And I had to, after that gig, I drove back to Boulder, packed a suitcase, got my guitars and my amp, and got on the bus the next morning to drive to Texas to play our first gig. So it was, for me, the perfect, being at the best place at the best time,
right.
Even though I wasn't a really good country player, and here I was, Neil Flans, the steel player, on the bus down. He was dropping the needle on a record and helping me try to learn James Burton's, you know, country licks, which was ridiculously hard to do. But, you know, I was not the best guy to be in the Fallen Angels with Graham. But, yeah, we rocked, and we were pretty solid, and we found our legs with me, the new guitar player, and, you know, and went out on the road for about a month and a half and played a bunch of cities, and, and that's where I met Rick Roberts at Max's Kansas City in New York City, and he said, "You live in Boulder? I live in Boulder. Hey, we should get together sometime."
It's amazing.
It's
a great story. I want to talk a little bit about Blindside. That's your most recent album, right?
My only album. I'm not a solo guy. I'm a band guy. I'm a lead guitar player who functions best when there's, you know, three or four or five other personalities and players around me. But
I love the album. Everybody needs to go out and get Blindside by Jock Bartley. My favorite song on there is "You Need Love." That's because, you know, you rock out on that one. That's an awesome tune. All the tracks are great. You got some slide there on "I Used to Say," which is another great song.
Right.
And
And that's another album that I tried to kind of promote and do myself.
Which is tough.
I sent a lot of copies of that to Europe. And certain songs off of the Blindside record got a lot of airplay over in Europe, you know. And, you know, it was like, wow, I didn't play in, you know, four sessions in France and all this kind of stuff. But it never turned into sales and whatever. And then, you know, a few months later, it was just over, you know. So trying to break commercially, you know, music is so difficult.
Oh, today it's ridiculous.
You can't do it. I mean, it's impossible today.
Yeah, it is, yeah. I mean, you know, look at mainstream radio. It's ridiculous. I was a top 40 guy back in the late 70s. So I played top 40 music. So I've seen all the changes. And, you know, there was still hope back then, even though disco was coming in and then you had New Wave and all that. But it was still a nice eclectic mix. I was still playing Zeppelin, you know, and stuff like that on the radio. You know, and Firefall, of course. But I did like the album. I really liked it. Yeah.
Thank you very much. And you know what? I've thought that, you know, there were a couple tunes on that I should somehow re-release or...
I think so.
Or do something, you know, with, and I just kind of have never gotten around to it. But that kind of brings me into the subject of, at long last, Firefall, as you know, is in the studio working on new music.
I heard something from Mark.
Yes, I'll bet you did.
I did. And I also heard something about Nature's Way.
You have, and I guess the cat's out of the bag. Our new manager and us have been figuring out, well, when are we going to be able to release the song and actually put it out there for people, you know, to hear and to buy and the consumption of all of that, which we're shooting for either July 1st or July 15th.
Awesome.
But also, when do you let the cat out of the bag that Nature's Way is happening with certain guest stars? And so Mark already answered that, and it's great.
Yes, he did. Don't get mad at Mark.
You know what?
I don't want to be in the middle of that.
For anybody who didn't hear the Mark Andes interview, one of Spirit's most amazing songs back in 68, 69, and they were happening in Spirit, by the way, for people who don't know about that kind of progressive underground rock band who made a lot of waves out of California back then. You know, they went on the road with Jimi Hendrix and Janis Joplin, the Big Brother and the Holy Company, and 10 years after, and, you know, all these great, amazing things. They played at the Atlanta Pop Festival. They were huge stars. I loved Spirit. And one of Randy California's best songs was Nature's Way, which is so ecologically pertinent right now still. So we started, after Mark rejoined the band about 4 years ago, he kind of thought that it would be a good idea to include some of our family tree and our genealogy from our past, not only including Spirit, but with the Byrds and Grant Parsons and different things from Firefall's genealogy tree. And I said, let's do Nature's Way. And he said, great. And Mark, of course, has never been a real lead singer, you know, a lead singer of a band that he's been in. And he's got a really good voice. And, you know, and we said, well, why don't you sing Nature's Way? And so for about the last 2 years, we've been adding it to our set, and it just goes over amazingly. And so I asked Mark a few months ago, well, I think we should record the song. I mean, it would be great. You know, who knows? It probably won't ever get on the radio, with radio being what it is today. But, you know, we deserve it. Mark, you deserve it. You know, Randy California deserves it. Let's do it.
Right.
And he said, okay.
Right.
And what was interesting was when Firefall did the Colorado Music Hall of Fame induction show, and Irving Azoff of the Eagles had allowed Timothy B. Schmidt to come and play with Poco for one night, which was up in the air for a month or two. They didn't know if Timmy was going to be able to or not. So backstage and in the dressing rooms, Poco's dressing room was right across the hall from Firefall's, Mark and Timothy B. Schmidt had met a few times, but never really got to be friends or hung out. And so that, after they had played and after we had played, Mark and Timothy were hanging backstage, and it was so cool to hear Mr. Timothy B. Schmidt, an Eagle, one of the biggest bands in history, tell Mark Andes, when I was a teenager in Sacramento, whenever Spirit would play in L.A. or San Diego or San Francisco, I'd take a 5 or 8 hour road trip and come and hear you guys play, and you were my hero. And Mark's kind of like blushing and going, well, thanks, didn't know what to say, but they really hit it off, and it was really cool to see them together, and I took a couple of really good pictures of the two of them, which we then put on Facebook and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, the Timothy B. Schmidt Band, after Glenn Frey had died and Timothy was doing a band of his own for a little while, they played in Houston where Mark lived, and Mark got off a few gigs of Firefall and that day went and heard Timothy B. Schmidt, and Mark, out of the blue, said, Firefall's recording Nature's Way, would you please sing on it? And Timothy said, absolutely. And so suddenly it was like, oh boy, when can we get it to him? And so we're about to mix and master the song next week. It's
awesome.
All finished. And not only is Timothy B. Schmidt from the Eagles on Nature's Way singing the second verse and harmonizing with Mark, which is great, but also John McVie from the Doobie Brothers played mandolin and some pedal steel on it. So we have a couple of guest stars, and we'll be putting Firefall's version of the Randy California song, Nature's Way. We'll be putting that out in July sometime, and we're very excited about it.
That's awesome. John is such a great musician, too, with the Doobie Brothers. I met him once here in Orlando, and he's such a good guy. That's going to be a
good
great...
guy, great musician.
Oh, yeah. That's going to be a great, great song when you guys put that out. I'm really looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to the whole album, of course.
Right. Well, you know, albums take so long, particularly when the five guys in the band live in different states. So we meet up in Florida when we've got a gig. Hey, but we're finishing up three or four other new Firefall songs, and we have one other surprise in our pocket that I can't tell you about. But I think what we're going to do is really try to finish five or six songs and put out an EP or a half an album or whatever, because if we would wait for 12 or 10 songs to get finished, you know, it wouldn't be till next year or whatever, and we want to definitely get Nature's Way out there as soon as possible. So we're in the middle of putting out some new product, and we're excited to get it out there and let our fans hear.
Good. I asked Mark, I said, you know, I had Rick Roberts on the show. You know, I know he had the accident and he went through hell with all that, but he sounded pretty good, you know, on the interview and everything. You think there's any chance he'll ever come back and do some few songs with you guys or something?
What may happen is Rick has a big catalog of unrecorded songs,
right?
And we've asked him to send us whatever he thought the, quote, new Firefall could, you know, might do. So we're looking at a few of the Rick Roberts songs to possibly include on this next album, because Rick's one of the greatest songwriters around and also wrote all of our hits. And, you know, when you think about all those songs from Firefall Records of the 70s, Strange Way and Just Remember I Love You and So Long and Living Ain't Living and all these great songs, so that's how we may plug Rick in. He is still battling trying to get his voice back.
Right.
And, you know, and God bless him, you know, he's not doing the, you know, he's written a couple of books, so he does these things where he'll go to a club and take a guitar and sing a few songs and tell stories about his past or, you know, whatever. And it's really cool. But in terms of being up to the level of professional singer that I know he would want to be at again, he's not quite there yet.
Right.
God love him. There wouldn't be a Firefall without Rick Roberts. Anybody asks.
Real good guy. We talked about his book. I had kind of the same discussion with Lou Graham from Foreigner. You know, it took him a long time to get back, but he's finally, you know, singing again after his issue.
Yeah, he was really sick for a while.
He almost died, He almost died.
Yeah, I mean, they took a brain tumor out of his brain that was the size of a tennis ball or a golf ball or something. I don't even know, but, you know, he's lucky to still be with us. And I tell you what, Lou Graham, back in the early days of Foreigner, you know, 78, 79, 80, there wasn't a better rock singer in the world than him.
That's right. You're
he
absolutely
was fantastic.
Right.
Fantastic.
Yeah,
absolutely fantastic.
Another guy that had issues, he's a friend of mine too, is Jesse Colin Young.
Had
Lyme disease for a long time, and he thought he was going nuts because they couldn't figure out what it was, and now he's back on the road. But
my older sister had that, and for the first 10 years they couldn't figure out what it was, and then they finally said, it's got to be Lyme disease. You must have been bitten by a tick. I had no idea that Jesse Colin Young had gone through that.
Well, you know, all my interviews on the radio, I've done a million interviews, but just the radio interviews are all on YouTube. If you punch in my name, you'll see them. And if you want to learn anything about Lyme disease, I got my interview with Jesse on there, if you know anybody that needs any help or anything, because he's got...
Wow.
He was cured, basically, but it took him a while.
I have seen some advertising of him playing gigs again.
Yep,
nowadays,
playing gigs again.
Which is great.
Yeah.
You know, and we all know, whether you're around the music industry or in as a player or a band, we all have a lot of those people who didn't make it past their addictions or didn't make it past any of the stuff that they went through, and it's just really sad, and you know, we're survivors, and to have, back to Firefall, to have Mark and David and I up on stage there,
incredible.
It's a very formidable thing.
Yeah.
And our new singer, Gary Jones, who from Nashville, who's been a friend of mine, sounds a lot like Rick Roberts from the records back in the 70s. You know, and our drummer, Sandy Ficka, kicks it out. And, you know, it's really powerful. And when you play, you know, not only all of Rick's great songs, but Larry's song, Cinderella, you know, when we play those live, you know, people are just like going, wow, and it's great. And I know how fortunate and lucky I am to still be in this position. And I know back to, you know, the 70s, how lucky I was to be at the right mm-hmm. place at the right time once or twice in my career to be suddenly on the road with Ram and Emmylou or meeting Rick Roberts and, hey, we got a record deal, you know. It was amazing, you know. That has to make you humble. It has to make you humble because you can't be on an ego trip about that because I know how many hundreds of thousands of great lead guitar mm-hmm. players there are out there who never got a break, you know?
Yeah. Well, you're a great guitar player, man.
Well, thank you.
You know, Cinderella is like, what an intro, you know? That's one of the great intros of all time is Cinderella. I got to mention one other thing on your album. I thought okay. Carlos Santana was on Just Let Go on that track. Oh, my God.
That's my son Jamie playing drums on that.
Really?
That's my Santana impression.
You got to do some more Latin music, man.
Yeah.
I'm serious.
My main influences, now I was a jazz and classically trained guitar player by the world famous
right.
guitar player Johnny Smith,
uh-huh.
who ended up, you know, his claim to fame, even though he played with Doc Severinsen and Stan Getz and Bing Crosby and all these great people, you know, his claim to fame is that he wrote Walk, Don't Run for the Ventures.
Right.
I was a trained guy, but boy, when the Beatles first came out, you know, it was like, oh, I didn't want to learn jazz chords anymore. I wanted to be in a band and play Beatles songs. And then when I heard Eric Clapton play the first time, that literally changed my life, you know, that when I bought Fresh Cream, and I'd never heard of that, but I liked the cover, I bought Fresh Cream and put the needle down, and, you know, his first solo, the heavens literally opened up, and suddenly that was possible, and I went, I want to do that. But I grew up on Clapton, George Harrison, and Carlos Santana, so
mm-hmm.
that's kind of a lot where my style and my tone and stuff came from. And it's interesting because you go, 15 years later than that, and a lot of young guitar players grew up on Eddie Van Halen, who's a great
right.
player, but
right.
suddenly there was a whole generation of guitar players who wanted to play breakneck fast all the time and
yeah.
kind of lost all of its melodic quality.
Exactly.
And one of the things that I learned from Johnny Smith,
yeah.
and I don't think he ever really said this to me. I saw by example, sitting across from him between the ages of 9 to about 13, was taste, being a tasteful player in music, isn't really what you play, it's what you don't play.
Right.
And that a lot of times the space and the holes you leave between musical passages speak louder than anything you could play.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of grew up having this tasteful, melodic way of answering back, you know, lyric vocalists and trying to play musical passages and not just licks. That was instilled in me from the time I was a little kid, so that by the time I was playing on Rick Roberts and Larry Burnett's songs, that just kind of came out, and, you know, and my melodic thing really fit with their melodic thing.
I swear to God, I thought you had Carlos Santana as a guest artist. It was...
Well,
when I wrote
that thing, I kind of thought there was somebody who was saying, hey, man, I got some connections in Brazil. We should write a song that sounds like Carlos Santana. And I was like, I can do that.
Yeah,
that's what it was about. And the whole Brazil thing fell through. But, yeah, that's me sounding like Carlos there.
Wow. Who played congos on that? You had a good congo player on there, too.
I don't even remember. Let's see. Probably a local Colorado guy.
Really? He was good.
It might have been Christian Teal, who's the drummer on the E-Town band out of Boulder. Every year, every week, they have different artists from James Taylor and Emmylou Harris to up-and-coming people that do that radio show on NPR. So it might have been Christian who played congas on it. I don't know. I can't remember.
Oh, that was a great tune, man. I want to hear more of that.
Cool. Yeah, you know, I have thought, because of that song, man, I could get together with, you know, a Latin writer or two and just nail a couple of tunes with me playing Santana in the background, and hey, let's go.
Yeah. I'd like to see you collaborate more, you know, with some really great legendary artists. That'd be awesome. 'Cause, you know,
yeah, man.
I think you'd be perfect
for that.
That's
what music's all about, sharing. Not only sharing in the writing and the creating and the recording, but, you know, after, you know, for Firefall to be in a position now to play on the road with Ohio Speedwagon or America or Orleans or Atlanta Rhythm Section or Christopher Cross, like we do quite a bit, is just such a gift. And so, you know, it's so amazing to be on the bill with a bunch of those guys who had a lot of hits back in the 70s too. So I know how fortunate I am.
You know, we almost had a super group in the making here. Jeff O'Kelly, who I've covered shows with, he's also takes pictures, he's a photographer or whatever. I know he was...
Oh, yeah, Jeff's great, and he works with Firefall and David Muse a lot.
And you guys were putting together the Boulder County Conspiracy, which had you, Bobby Caldwell, who I've had on the show, which Bobby's awesome, Joe Lala, David Muse, and Rick Roberts.
At times, there was also Paul Cotton from Poco and one or two other people.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a lineup.
And it never quite got off the ground, and we played like two gigs and kind of fell through. I have a surprising little tidbit for you. I have a new musical project on the side going with two of the guys from the Subdudes, John Maggie and Steve Amadei. And the bass player that we've been having play with this is Kenny Passarelli, who was in Barnstorm and helped write Rocky Mountain Way. So
I just had Kenny on the show.
We don't have a band name yet, but we're writing a lot of funky songs, kind of a la Levon Helm and the band back in the day. And John Magny's just the funkiest guy I know. And so we got a new project going out, and I'll let you know the name of it when we finally pick one.
I just had Kenny and Joe Vitale on the show. We did a tribute show, and I'm losing my mind now. The guy who's replacing Zephyr.
Tommy Bolin.
Tommy Bolin. I'm losing it. That's what happens when you get to a certain age. But we did a tribute show to Tommy Bolin, and Kenny's a great guy, and me and Joe traded books because we're both authors. And, that's awesome. That'll be a great project. Kenny's an awesome
Guy. The songs are amazing, and frankly, nothing like anything that's being put out now. Cause when you think about the Subdudes, you know, and Steve Amadei, who everybody thought, you know, and he is a great drummer, but in their heyday, pretty much he only played a tambourine and made it sound like a set of drums. But it's so much fun, and I'll keep you posted on that.
We'll have you back on the show.
Kenny Passarelli, I've heard tell that Joe Walsh is reforming for a tour or two or gigs, is reforming Barnstorm after they were inducted into the Colorado Music Hall of Fame last summer. And I was there and saw them play, and it was just fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, and Kenny's one of the best bass players around, and Joe Vitale, his resume, not only as a drummer but a flute player, you know, he and Mark Andes used to play in Dan Fogelberg's band for about 5 years.
Yep. That's another shame, you know, Dan Fogelberg. I loved him, man. He had such a cool voice, you know, such a great voice.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He loved
getting old sucks and different ailments. I'm battling some arthritis, which is a challenge a little bit, but I know that so many other people have much more, you know, serious things going on. I just know how fortunate I am to still be doing this and have people want to buy tickets to hear Firefall play because those songs are still meaningful for them. So
yes, they are.
I've always kept it since I've been band leader of Firefall for the last 35 years or whatever. You know, to me, Firefall's great because as band leader, I know that people are coming to, are paying money and coming to see us to hear You Are the Woman or Just Remember I Love You or Cinderella sound like it's supposed to on the record. And
right.
by God, I want to keep those songs
right.
really sounding like they're supposed to. And, you know, a lot of bands, you know, and you can't blame them sometimes, but a lot of bands get so tired of playing their one big hit that they change it around and just to keep their own interest. And, you know, and they play the song and nobody can tell it's their favorite song until the chorus hits. And you go, what the heck?
I
keep a really tight rein on, you know, those three-minute songs or three-and-a-half-minute songs that people come to hear from Firefall, those have to sound like that. But at the same time, we have Strange Way and Mexico and Livin' Ain't Livin' to where David and I and Mark can stretch out and go places musically that maybe on a given night you've never been before. And you go and just jam and spontaneously play solos and take it wherever it's going to go. That is so cool to be able to still do.
But, you know, you're talking about stretching it out. You guys can get away with it because you've got that way about you where you can, you know, kind of get into that jam, and it sounds like the song, no matter how you present it. You know, it's kind of like Angry Eyes from Loggins and Messina. You know, that same kind of thing that you can just kind of stretch it out, and it's still the song, and it just gets better and better and better. Bands like Zeppelin cannot do it. I've seen Zeppelin several times, and when they stretch a song, it's terrible. You know, it's horrible, and they don't know how to do it. And then you get Plant going, for like 5 minutes, and it's like, what were we hearing? What song were we hearing? You know?
Right.
But you guys do.
And, you know, other awesome bands who would like to be able to be a jam band, too, or at least stretch out and do stuff, their material might not suit that.
True.
And Firefall's a rare case where, you know, You Are the Woman, we could never stretch out. You know, Just Remember I Love You. Nope, that's how it is supposed to be, and we're going to play it. It's 3.5 minutes long, period. You know, but Mexico or Strange Way, you know, David sometimes goes brand new places on that flute solo of his.
Yep.
And, you know, it's really great because Firefall, you know, there'll be times when we'll get like 10 or 12 standing ovations during a gig, and you're going, wow, that's, you know, they love us.
Yeah. You guys are masters of that. You guys are,
well,
you cannot screw up a song.
Oh, believe me, you could. And we could.
Jock, here's your last question, okay?
This is
a question I ask everybody, and I get some very interesting answers from this. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform, collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Oh, my gosh. To perform with or just to meet or in chat?
No. You got to play with them. Performing, collaborating with, playing guitar with.
Well,
and they could be passed away.
So many names come to mind, but you know, I would love to be able to have traded licks with my hero Eric Clapton.
With Clapton,
you know, and the guy that he's got playing, the left-handed guitar guy, Doyle Bramlett or Doyle somebody, can't think of his last name. I'm sorry, but he's got a great lead guitar player playing with him now from Austin, Texas. You know, and I know Eric, you know, sits in with a lot of people. So I'd have to say maybe Eric Clapton, you know, and if it was anybody in history, you know, any one of the Beatles. Just let me at them, you know. It's like, oh, my God. The Beatles, you know, are still, you know, the best band ever. You know, when you think about the Beatles, and in 1 2-year period, they made Rubber Soul, Revolver, Yesterday and Today, and started Sergeant Pepper's, all in 2 years.
Like, that's crazy.
It's amazing to think of how great the songwriters were, and then talk about the chemistry in the studio with those four band guys and George Martin and Jeff Emmerich, the engineer. It's just like
unbelievable.
So the Beatles are still the best ever and probably never to be challenged in my book.
They could have done anything without George Martin. And then also, I guess, their engineers, was it Emmerich?
Jeff Emmerich.
Yeah. But
it's interesting, too, because if you read Jeff Emmerich's book, they deliberately started trying at a certain point, not Rubber Soul, but in Revolver and then leading into Sgt. Pepper's, they started trying to paint pictures with the music. And they put stuff up there that would be this visual, take people away kind of thing.
Right.
And
right.
me being a painter, too, it, you know, like when you're in the studio and you're making a mix of a song and you're going to put the tambourine over here in this corner and you'll put the vocals over here and you'll put the guitar here and it's like doing a painting kind of, except it's all auditory. And they were the masters of that, you know, of taking you away in 3.5 or 4 minutes. Physically putting you in a different place, and then when the song ended, you come back and go, "Wow, how great is that?"
Yeah,
music.
You know, that's why album covers were so important, because that kind of started it. You know, you look at the album cover, and then you get into the music, and it's already you got a mental picture of what the music might sound like. You know,
right? That's like the first album cover of Firefall, where I had the idea of something to do with either a comet or fire falling from the sky, you know, and the art director of Atlantic Records said, "Hey, great idea, kid, thanks, we'll take it from here." And they had the first album, Firefall, cover with the comet reflecting in the lake. They did that photographically and then airbrushed, but perfect cover. It just looked like Colorado, and when you saw that and then listened to the songs, you're going, "Wow, it was great." So it's all a combination of me being an artist and musician and all of that. It's kind of all tickling people's senses, you know?
Yeah, a lot of musicians are artists, you know? They do
yes,
paint,
they are.
You know? Yeah. Did you meet Ahmed from Atlantic Records?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. Only a few times, and I don't remember what time, where Ahmed and Rick Roberts and I drank so much sake and just got shit-faced. Pardon me, I probably can't say that, but it's like...
Yeah, sure, go ahead. We're okay.
But, Ahmet was... You know, if you think about, you know, Ahmet and Aretha and Ray Charles and he and Tom Dowd's history with Atlantic Records, it was such
amazing.
An honor to be on Atlantic Records when we got signed. And I was told, I'm not sure that this is still true, but when Firefall's first album came out, it went gold faster than any other album preceding it on Atlantic Records, which you're going,
I read that.
Wow. There's Led Zeppelin, there's Aretha, there's know, all these great acts, you know, and you know, it was really cool. Very cool, and you know, I just, it's great to still be doing it after all these years, and the Firefall songs that we play on stage still get people off, and we love talking to them and seeing their smiling faces.
Jock, I want to thank you, man, for being on the show today. And of course,
my pleasure. Thank you for a great interview and really cool questions.
For all the incredible music you've given us, you're on the road again coming up. You got some. Are you guys thinking at all about going overseas?
If we get hired, yeah. I mean, we've been to Europe 4 or 5 times, and Japan probably 4 or 5 times, too. I haven't heard of anything upcoming, but with all the groups that we play with, like Atlanta Rhythm Section or Ambrosian or Orleans or a lot of those bands that had big hits in the 70s, too, you would think a package would work great in Europe.
Definitely. Definitely.
I hope we go.
Yeah. That'll be awesome. Well, keep in touch, man. I want to know about the new album, and you know, Nature's Way. I definitely want to play that over the air.
We'll send you a copy as soon as it's done.
I appreciate it, Jock. Thank you so much, man.
Thank you, Ray. I appreciate it. It's been a great interview, and we'll see all our fans out on the road. Thanks.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks, man.
For more information, about Jack Bartley and Firefall, visit www.firefallofficial.com or www.facebook.com/firefallofficial. Purchase the most recent release by Firefall, Reunion Live, February 26, 2009 at amazon.com. Very special thanks to Trace Keane for arranging this interview with Jack Bartley, and of course the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of VBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of the Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at theRayShashoShow@gmail.com. Don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business. Or the second edition, Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C. Available now at Amazon.com. I promise you'll live it. Have a great week.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at PublicityWorksAgency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.